Okay, good evening, folks. Welcome to Climb Sci episode 10 with Brian Rigby.
Hello, everyone, and Tom Herbert.
Good evening. So it appears that we have Aquaman with us this evening.
Oh, man.
Magnificent beard.
I thought you were talking about my glimmering scales.
Well, that as well. And your shimmering tail.
Yeah, you know, we're working on them. The beard is just a side effect.
Well, you know, one of us has to have good testosterone.
Well, this is if you're watching YouTube, you can see all of its glory, but this is over a month of not shaving. I have friends who this is what they look like after 4 days, if not less. This is as good as it gets. I could never shave again, and it's not going to get much longer than this.
All right. Well, there we go.
I mean, Tom, I would be willing to bet you can grow a better beard than me.
This is like 2 days. This is literally like I could have shaved this morning. So, you know. Anyways, well, thank you for staying with us for that intro. So tonight, though on episode 9 we said that we were going to do there was rumors that we're going to do a weight loss podcast. Tonight, actually, what we're going to do is we're going to be talking about climbing nutrition priorities. Basically, what is kind of the order of what you should be looking at if you are to construct and practice the best climbing nutrition for yourself. And we'll include a little bit of weight loss, but I think we'll probably do a big weight loss podcast for the new year. Probably number 11 would be good for that, to try and get that out.
11 or, you know, maybe 12, depending if we do another Q&A. But it seems like the new year is a better time to talk about it rather than depress everyone, you know, when we're entering the holiday season and we're all looking forward to some delicious food. Let's not bum people out by talking about weight loss right now. No one wants that.
No. Okay. So if you do happen to be watching the YouTube clip, I still haven't worked out how to get this separate audio and video working well. So I'm going to be flicking back and forth between myself and Aquaman. Right, Brian, do you want to kick us off? Give us a little bit of an overview.
Sure.
And we can jump straight in.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Tom said, we're going to talk about priorities for sports nutrition tonight. Because while it's nice to think that, you know, you can do it all, the reality is nutrition, while it's not work in the same sense that like training is work, it requires a lot of mental focus. And you can go pretty far deep in that, and it can be very mentally tiring to try to take care of everything, you know, and do the absolute maximum that you can possibly do. And the other reality with that is you get diminishing returns as you keep investing more and more and more into it, just like training. You know, if you train at all, you're way better off than somebody who doesn't train. But if you train a ton, you're only getting marginal gains at a certain point. So what we want to do is help you as a climber to do the most that you can for your nutrition, depending on how much time and effort you really want to invest in it. So what are the big things that you should be doing? Definitely, you know, if you care at all about nutrition, what should you be doing? And then go from there. You know, if you're a little bit more interested, you want to tweak it a little bit further, you know, what's the next step? What's the step after that? Not only is this good to like get your priorities straight, but it also helps you not devote time into doing things that Tom and I would probably say aren't worth spending that much time doing. Because I think that we see that. I mean, I feel like I see that a decent amount, and perhaps people in the UK do not. I mean, perhaps Tom's clientele is different, but I feel like there's certain things that I see people want to do that are time consuming and take a lot of effort, but that probably aren't that important unless you are already doing all these other things and you have the time and energy and if you're going to get something from it. You know, because some people, some of these things, you know, you get to a certain level and, you know, if you're not a pro climber, if your livelihood isn't based on this, some of these things just probably aren't even going to be worthwhile at the end of the day. But there are things that are worthwhile, and that's what we're going to, that's what we're going to drill up, starting from the things that are the most worthwhile and moving towards these kind of fringe things that may or may not be worth it, depending on who you are, how much time you have, how much effort, and you, what your goals are.
Yeah, and really, it's the reason behind this is we want to give you the ideas of what is going to create the biggest change, and what is going to be where you should be spending your majority of your time, and then how it moves up. So, it's really basically a kind of pyramid of priority.
Right. Yeah, I wrote an article, I think, about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, called the Sports Nutrition Pyramid. It's the basic idea of it. Just, you know, different levels of you have to do certain things in order to get benefits from other things. So you can't just build the top of a pyramid and have it be a pyramid. I mean, I guess it's a miniature pyramid if you do that in one way when you look at it, because pyramids are, of course, you know, the top of a pyramid is like a miniature pyramid, but let's forget about that for now. The idea is you have to start from the base. You know, you do the big things first because you'll get the most benefit out of them. And some of these smaller things rely on you doing those bigger things even before they will get you any benefit.
Yeah. And to be honest, this is the bread and butter of a coach. What I'm telling you today, what we're telling you today, is really what we do with people,
right.
and basically the order.
Right, so, exactly. It's paying somebody to help them do these things, help them figure it out. So
exactly. So okay. Now, what's interesting is whether or not there's going to be some crossing over between me and Brian. As always, we don't prepare by having a long conversation about the stuff beforehand, because we like, and I think you do as well, a kind of open conversation between us. So I think let's start from, you've got a new person who's come to you for advice, either as a paying client or somebody, as our listeners are, that we want to give the primary advice to. So tell me, where do we start when we want to get our nutrition in order?
Well, the first thing, you know, the biggest thing that I'm concerned with, not necessarily the thing that we're going to spend the most time on, but just the biggest question is, how many calories is this person eating? So for example, when a new client comes in, you know, I'll get some general health data about them, you know, height, weight, and then, you know, like energy levels. I have a questionnaire that people will fill out, but I'll also have them give me some diet logs. And it's not so much necessarily to see exactly what foods they're eating. It's more, I want to know, or even like the percentages of fat and protein and carbohydrates. That's all important, and that will come into play later. In the short term, you know, on this first glance, I just want to know how much they're eating compared to how large they are and how much activity they're doing. Because calories is energy, and energy is, you know, that's how we do things. It's so obvious, it doesn't even need to be said. But one of the big things that I see is people just not eating enough, you know, not getting enough calories. You don't have the calories to spend, you're not going to be able to spend them on doing things like climbing.
Yeah. And I think this is what is interesting about this is that there are many people who will skim, I'm going to flick the video, will skim the fine edge of what is enough energy. And the body is very good at conserving energy. And what generally happens is that if you're eating just enough or even slightly below in a kind of wave fashion, your body will slow down to try and match that output. You can get into real trouble if you are in a constant deficit, of course. But That's for another podcast. But the what both Brian and I do is to try and understand. Well, let me speak about what I do is really is the same thing as Brian. I try and understand what the person's lifestyle is and what they do on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And in terms of just their output without too much detail. And then we look at, okay, so this is the foods that you're eating and this is how much. Is this enough for your body in a general sense? So Brian, how do we determine a kind of base level of intake for somebody? And is that something actually that you start with, or how do you go about things? And I'm thinking that because we've got kind of going back and forth, I'm thinking maybe it would be interesting is we look at each of these and we both talk about how we each do them and whether or not the order is different. So
sure.
So yeah. So maybe you carry on.
Okay. Well, we know we have calculations that we can do to figure out a basal or a resting metabolic rate. And there's, you know, debate about how accurate they are. You know, if you were going to just like use this one number, I would say that it's not going to be super accurate, but we know that it's going to be in the general range. So we'll figure out what the resting metabolic rate is, not even activity adjusted, just, you know, how much energy they're going to spend just by upkeeping their body. And, you know, doing the minimal amount of everyday chores that we all do. This isn't a basal metabolic rate, which would be just how much your body takes, because that's much different. That'd be harder to figure out. This is including, you know, very light activity of like you wake up, you eat food, you walk to the bathroom, you go to the bathroom, stuff like that. And from there, that's kind of the baseline that I said. That's where I'll say, okay, we know that you're going to be in the ballpark of this number. And as Tom said, it's a little hard to know for sure because our body is very good at shifting things around. It'd be nice if our body did have this one like single this static point where if you were on one side of it, you gained weight. And if you were on the other side of it, you lost weight. But our body doesn't work like that. Our body is going to shift various processes within it in order to maintain homeostasis, try to maintain that weight. So if you eat a little bit too little one day, you know, you're not going to lose weight. Your body's just going to slow down your metabolism in a certain area. And if you eat a little bit too much another day, same thing's going to happen. It's going to, you know, speed up your metabolism. You know, maybe you'll twitch a little bit more throughout the day. Those are kind of random examples, but the idea is there's not this single point. So, but we have to start with the point. And so this starting point for me will be this resting metabolic rate. And then, you know, outside of weight loss, I'm not going to talk about weight loss right now because obviously the strategy will be different with that. But where I'll go next is I want them to start eating, you know, at least that amount. And actually we'll start increasing calories slowly so that we can reach a point. I want to know at approximately how many calories they need to be eating in order to start gaining weight. Because that's the next important point that we have. We know that at that point, they're getting more calories than their body needs or knows what to do with. And if their goal is muscle gain, then that's beneficial, right? Because you can't gain weight, you can't gain muscle without gaining weight, at least not unless you're losing equal amounts of fat. And that is, you know, after the novice stage of training, just a pipe dream, that's not going to happen to a large extent. But most climbers, we're not worried about muscle loss or muscle gain. So I'm going to push them to the point where they start gaining weight, and then we'll pull them back a little bit and determine that that is roughly the point at which they are getting their maximal calorie intake that they are going to gain benefit out of.
Yeah, exactly. So in terms of the practicality of this, right? This is the big foundation of our pyramid. This is the base of our pyramid, is understanding where your energy balance is. So there's two ways that you can do this, right? There is one that involves more numbers, and then there's one that just involves looking at your habits, right? Mm-hmm. So when I take on a new client, the first thing I actually ask them to do is just to keep a diary of everything they eat for a week. And The reason I do that is so I can see the sort of foods that they like, they like to eat, but also I can see it as a kind of overview of the amounts or the types of food. So it doesn't need to be so exact. So I ask people to, you know, roughly estimate what they're eating. And it's inevitably going to be wrong. We know that from research.
Right.
But what I can see...
People are terrible at measuring food.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. But what it does give me is that I can then take, as Brian's mentioned, we can take some things like your height, circumference measurements. I often pass people some photos of body fat percentages and ask them where they sit in that body fat percentage. And from there, I can basically use, and you can do this too, is basically you can use an RMR calculator or BMR calculator, which you can find online. There's many of them. And what it can do is just from an estimation will give you your resting metabolic rate for your weight and your lean body mass. I use Catch-McArdle is the calculation I use. And then from there, we use something which is basically like it's called an activity multiplier. And what I tend to do, I don't know about Brian, is I actually use sedentary as my default.
That's what I do as well.
Yeah. And the reason being is that when you go and search for an RMR or metabolic calculator, you'll see things like sedentary being 1.2, slightly active being 1.375 and things like that. And what these tend to do is they overestimate mostly.
Yeah, yeah. You're going to overestimate because you'll read them and they have descriptions that definitely fit how you feel about yourself. There are things like moderately active. And you're like, oh, yeah, I'm a moderately active person. But what they're talking about is like moderately active every single day. And they define moderate activity as like 4+ hours of exercise, which doesn't really translate to the way most of us are moderately active. So they overestimate. You probably are a moderately active person, but you're not burning that many calories on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So what I do is... And this is why I'm going to, it will make sense in a minute, is that I choose basically a multiplier of normally 1.1 or 1.2, depending on what the person says they do for a living. If they are a normal office worker, then I normally use, I get their RMR value from a calculator online. There's many of them. I think the one I use a lot is Omni Calculator, and I do it on a spreadsheet. So search for an RMR calculator, Catch-McArdle or Harris-Benedict equation. There's hundreds of them out there. Put your estimated body fat in. It's better to estimate up rather than down on your body fat. Most climbers I work with go from about probably about 14-15% body fat, and they think they're about 11 or 12% body fat. That will give you your lean body mass, which you put into the calculator, and you'll get a number out. And then what you do is just multiply that number by the lowest activity multiplier, which will be, I think, 1.2. And what you have now is a kind of an estimate of your energy expenditure without doing any training, right?
Right. Now, it's like a rest
now what day. I do, yeah. And the reason I take this is, and this isn't, I don't give this to a client. What I do is I look at this, and then I look at their diary that they've given me. And I calculate roughly what they're eating on a weekly basis or daily basis and look at it against this number. And then I ask them for a kind of training diary so I can estimate the type of energy expenditure that they're doing training. And almost always, I don't bother with any precision mathematics. I choose if they're doing a kind of normal hour of resistance training or an hour of climbing, I do anything from about 300 calories to about 500 calories, depending on the person. If there's someone who's doing a double training day, then I might push it up to 600 calories. Mm-hmm. But with all this, what I want to stress for you, when we're trying to find this base of this pyramid, is that the numbers at the moment actually don't really matter.
Right.
What we want to see is we want to choose something And then you look at that in comparison to what changes. And this is what Brian has stressed, is that at the end of the day, if I know that someone is eating a certain amount and they've come to me and my first point was just somebody trying to define a goal, right? So obviously the goal would either be weight loss or performance or something like that. But if we say that we're going to be working with a climber who wants to optimize their nutrition for performance, right? Then we're going to try and find the most amount of food that we can give this person without them significantly gaining weight. We want them to be in energy balance almost all the time, 90% of the time. And we want to keep scaling the food up until we push that. So what we have is you go away, you find this number, you look at your food intake and you see how they match. And you literally start making a change. So what you can do, if this all sounds very confusing with the numbers, chuck the numbers away.
Right.
What you do is you know what you generally eat every single day. What you do is you get on the scale every day and you eat what you normally eat and then you make a change.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we're going to do, let's add in a piece of fruit every day.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see, is my weight changing? No, it's not changing. Okay, let's add some more carbs. Let's add some more protein. Just add more food. Maybe you're going to have an extra meal and you're going to see, is my weight changing? And you keep doing this until you start seeing a kind of significant amount of weight gain, which might be, say, 0.1, 0.2 a day kilos. So it's tricky because your weight is going to fluctuate with water anyway.
Right. We're looking for trends. You got to track a trend.
Exactly.
Not just
exactly.
Like a single day. Like, oh, I gained a little weight. I better pull off. That's
not at all.
One day. Yeah. But
no, if you're doing this on your own, then probably like 2 weeks or something like that. Mm-hmm. And just I would wait. I mean, I get my guys to weigh every day, but I ask them to record their weight on a spreadsheet for me every week
right.
on the Sunday. And that at least leads me to see.
Yeah, I'll have them record. You know, if we're tracking that, then it'll be daily weighing, but weekly average is what I'll consider. But yeah, like Tom said, the numbers aren't actually, when we're talking about like resting metabolic rate and calories taken in, those numbers are important for somebody like Tom and I who are taking a client and, you know, we're not that person. We're not eating their food every day. Like we have no way to know what they're doing or where they are except through those numbers because we're not with them the entire time. At least nobody's paid me to shadow them every day for a week yet. So we need those numbers, but you don't. You're living this. And you can just completely forget about those numbers and do what Tom said. Just, you know, the one number you'll need is your weight because you can't track a change in weight without a number. But otherwise, you don't need to know what your resting metabolic rate is. You just need, or how many calories you're consuming. You just need to know that if you eat more food, that's more calories. And that your resting metabolic rate, if you are currently maintaining weight, that your resting metabolic rate is probably somewhere around what you're currently eating.
Yeah. And the big thing about this is that is a way for you to control this base of the pyramid. So if you make it very complicated right at the beginning and start fussing around with numbers and mathematics, it becomes very tricky for you to make any adjustment because you're changing the way your life is. If you are eating what you currently eat and you decide to have an extra meal every day of, let's say, some rice and some tuna fish, right? You have rice and tuna fish and something else. And you suddenly eat that meal every single day and your weight does not change. That's fantastic. That is some really, really good information because you've suddenly upped your protein and your carbohydrate intake and your energy trend, your weight trend has not actually changed. What that means is that your body is using what you've given it
mm-hmm.
and you're probably going to notice that you have maybe more energy or you're recovering better.
Right.
Or something like that. This is where it becomes – yeah, carry on.
I was gonna say, it's insidious. These small deficits, you don't notice them necessarily, but they're there. You know, your body, if you give it calories, it's going to do something with them. And if you don't give them those calories, then it obviously can't use them. So yeah, if you give them calories, you might just be more energetic while you're climbing. It might not even necessarily feel like a lot. Mm. You know, it's not going to be like you took some caffeine and suddenly you just like are hyper and amped to go. It might not be like that, but you know, over time it will make a difference. The important thing is if you're not gaining weight, like Tom said, you're using those calories. They're not just disappearing, probably. There's a small chance you're just pooping them out.
Yeah. One thing I will say, though, is that, and you're probably aware now since if you've been listening to the podcast, if you tend to eat lower carbohydrate and you start increasing your carbohydrate intake, your weight will jump up probably 1 or 2 kilos in that space of the 1 or 2 weeks. Right. But this is where you need to just make a decision to see where that scale weight starts plateauing. So I would recommend people, and I mean, I have a run-in of 2 weeks or 2 or 3 weeks before I even ask people to change anything really dramatically, because I need to understand how that's impacting them when I set some targets. So keep your weight, check that, watch how it changes, and keep an eye as well. You know, keep your training logs and see how you feel by eating more, your recovery, your sleep, and your mood and things like that. And you might be surprised how much more food you can actually put in before you start seeing that weight shift up.
Okay. I want to say like one thing, like this is the base of our pyramid for a few reasons. But one big reason is that this is pretty easy for any person to do because it doesn't require large habit changes. Like the only habit change that we're asking people to make on this stage is just to eat more food. You know, we're not talking like you don't have to eat more carbohydrates. If, you know, if your diet is pretty heavy fat based, you can keep eating the same types of foods, just more of them. You know, or less of them if you're looking at weight loss. That it's just that simple. You know, they're not habit changes. They are in a sense that you're eating more and that is going to require you to think about it for a little bit. You know, making a concerted effort every day to eat a little bit more, but it doesn't require you to change the foods you're eating or the time of the foods you're eating necessarily. Those are changes that you can make, but at this stage, they are not, those specifics aren't essential.
Yeah. Exactly. And what you'll find actually is that one of the reasons that a lot of people or certain type of body type ends up being involved in climbing is because they tend to be generally leaner individuals anyway. And they also tend to be individuals who seem to automatically regulate their food intake and not put on that much weight in comparison to some of the people you work with or something like that, right? And this is actually why it is useful for you to do some level of tracking, not necessarily calorie tracking, but rather just a diary of what you're eating, because you'll be surprised how when you start watching what you eat, well, put it like this, 100% of my clients who start the 7-day journal lose weight that week. I've never had a client who has taken a 7-day journal and has been the same weight than when I first asked them for their weight. So when you become more conscious of what you're eating, you tend to eat less anyway. But my point is that because you're trying to see this, you're trying to find the point which you start gaining weight, you will notice that there will probably be times when you'll be eating a lot and then you don't really feel like eating much more because this becomes a kind of a normal ebb and flow of what you've been doing all the time anyway. But this is where you want to start pushing the envelope and saying, okay, so this feels a little bit different because I don't normally eat so much on, let's say, a Saturday or something or whatever, whenever you're having a recovery day or whatever. But just keep going and finding that weight.
Right. Yeah. That is probably the hardest part. You're not currently eating more because most likely because you just don't feel like it. And So you're going to be doing something that your body is telling you, I don't really feel like this. That's hard. That's the hardest part about any of these changes. You know, fighting what you feel is normal.
Yeah. And that's where the money is, to be honest, because that's what people pay us to help them with, is to try and push that. And
right.
Almost everybody feels fantastic when they're like, oh man, I'm eating a lot and I feel great.
Yeah.
So we've got now to the point where, okay, we're asking, we're getting to this point where, okay, right, I'm eating more. My weight's staying the same. Okay, so what's the next stage of, you know, what's the next priority in terms of doing the best we can with our nutrition?
Right. And just as a quick aside, I want to say that these aren't sequential necessarily. Tom and I aren't saying like, do this stage first, then do this one, then do this one, then do this one. These all could be overlapping. Rather, this is like, how much energy are you investing? How much time are you investing into this? You know, if you're only going to invest a little bit, do what we just said. You know, get your calories dialed in. That's the biggest thing. But if you're going to take it a little bit further, then you're at the same time as you're dialing in your calories, you're probably also going to be doing these next things that we're going to talk about. So for me, I've actually, like in my article, I have a tier two and a tier three, and I had to separate them out. I kind of feel like I want to flip them. They're pretty similar is what I will say. They're pretty close to each other, and I feel like you could probably go either way on them, just depending on what, you know, perhaps what your own psychology is, like what is going to be easier for you, because for some people... let me say what the next two tiers are, and then, you know, Tom can add his own opinion on it. But I have sort of the second thing that you might want to concern yourself with is either nutrient timing. So when are you taking food in, or meals? And then the other thing that you could be concerned with is macronutrient goals. So what are the specifics of the calories that you're consuming? Are they, you know, where are they coming from? How many are protein, carbohydrates, and fat? And yeah, I put, you know, originally I put nutrient timing as slightly more important than macronutrient goals. But I would say that in actually a real life situation where you, as a real life human being with your own psychology, choose, if you're only going to devote a little bit more time and effort to this, choose the one that's going to be easier to you. For some people, timing meals, like you might just, it might be more of an ordeal to time your meals than it is to just eat more carbohydrates in a day. Like maybe you have a very specific work schedule, and it's just going to be too much effort to, you know, take meals in at, you know, at a specific time. Your schedule dictates what your eating time is, and to change that would be too much effort. In which case, nutrient timing is not something that you should be worried as much about. But on the other hand, I put that slightly above macronutrient goals because for a lot of people, the foods that we eat those foods because we enjoy them. And changing the foods that you enjoy, changing the details of your diet, like moving from a person who loves to eat a ton of nuts and seeds, and you know that's what makes them happy throughout the day, to someone who's eating more sweet potatoes to try to get more carbohydrates, that's a bigger change, I think, for most people psychologically, but not necessarily for you. So that's why I'd say that as far as the difference that these two goals will make to your climbing, macronutrient goals, especially carbohydrate-wise, will probably make a bigger difference. But assuming that you're eating a decent amount of carbohydrates already, then they're probably pretty similar.
Yeah, I think the easiest way to separate the two paths that you can do in terms of an overview of the sports nutrition is either going down a kind of numbers route or going down a food habit food volume route. So what we're saying is that you're now in the place where you're eating food right? You have a general idea of what you're doing.
Food. No longer are you just picking up random objects and putting them in your mouth, saying, "Is this food?" No, you know what it is. You're putting it in your mouth and you're eating it.
What I'm saying is that. Is if we go down to the root of somebody who's not concerned with numbers, right? They're waking up in the morning and they're having a breakfast which they normally have, let's say, which is some eggs and some toast and some fruit, right? And their coffee, right? That's their breakfast. For lunch, it may vary, but it normally is going to have some amount of meat that they don't really measure. It's just what comes in the sandwich or what they've brought to the thing, which could be, you know, a chicken breast or a can of tuna and some carbs, which they made. And then for dinner, it's the same sort of thing. They cook a piece of meat or they cook a half a box of tofu, or they're having tofu and beans, which they normally have. These are normal amounts of foods which they are normally having. Right. And they've been scaling this up to get their energy balance. Right. Mm-hmm. What we're then saying is that there are two things we can go down. We can say, OK, from a sports nutrition point of view, what is the optimal amount of, say, protein, carbs and fats that would benefit you? But let's say we leave that for a moment and we say, OK, so how can I take the foods that I'm currently eating and make it better fit the activities that I'm doing? So this is why these two things are crossing over, is that if we go now to, let's say we look at this nutrient timing, what we're merely saying is that if you've listened to the previous podcasts, you'll understand that carbohydrates are going to fuel the power and strength that you're going to be doing in your training. So when we talk about nutrient timing, we're looking at saying maybe we should be placing the carbohydrate that we're eating nearer the training and around the training so that we can have that glucose coming in that we're digesting to fuel that session, and then the glucose from the carbohydrate after the session to recover our glycogen stores. That's where we are simply taking what we normally do habitually with the meals that we eat and just shuffling things around. Maybe the easiest way that you can increase your food is to do your normal three meals a day, and then just before you do your training, you start using things like some fruit or some sort of sugary carbs or even potatoes or something like that,
right,
within your session. So there you've made a change to your diet without doing any measuring. But you've implemented a increase in your food coming in, which is going to increase your calories. But you've also done nutrient timing, because those carbs around your session are going to be far more beneficial than, say, consuming them all at night.
Right. Exactly. I mean, we have muscle glycogen. You know, helps us. We're not, as long as you're consuming carbohydrate any time of the day, of course, you're going to have muscle glycogen stores. In other words, it's going to help you throughout a session. But we also know that if you provide those carbohydrates in the context of exercise, then you have your blood glucose is up. You just have access. Your muscles have access to more glucose, and that's going to yield a benefit during exercise. So timing-wise, yeah, that's probably the biggest aspect. If we can time a lot of your carbohydrates around your exercise, preferably before and during, you know, especially for a longer session before and during that session or that day, you know, of climbing or whatever, then we know that you're going to get some benefit. Mm-hmm. So this is beyond, though, the benefit of just eating more calories. You know, if you just up your carbohydrate content without worrying about timing, your muscle glycogen stores are increasing. You'll still get a benefit.
Sure.
That's that first base. But now we're looking at what can we do that's even a little bit more specific. And that's what this is. This is eating more carbohydrates during and around exercise. Give you just a little bit more benefit. But it also requires you to change, at this point, a very specific habit when you are having a meal.
Exactly. And what I always stress to clients, and it's also for my benefit as a coach, is to never change too many things at once, because you want to understand what you're doing and having a means. So, you know, including an extra piece of fruit per day is a very easy thing to measure for yourself without knowing any of the numbers. So that's something to keep in mind. Another aspect you can talk about in terms of nutrient timing is very briefly, there's more and more data on circadian rhythm, meaning that your body has a clock, you have a hormonal ebb and flow, and that it appears to be that having the bulk of your food during the day in the daylight hours and tapering that off towards the evening appears to be more beneficial than doing it the other way around. We're not mice, so we don't really need huge amounts of calories going into the period where we're sleeping. What we also see is that even without reducing energy intake, there's a number of studies that are coming out to show that by having the majority of your food at breakfast, lunch, and a kind of early dinner, so you're compressing the amount of food that you're having into the kind of typical daylight hours, actually can improve health markers, blood markers, even without energy restriction. So in terms of a nutrient timing thing, this can have an impact in that way. And I know it's very trendy for people to skip breakfast, but I think we'll probably do a podcast maybe on fasting when we do the weight loss. But I think there's actually enough warrant now, and I'm recommending to clients to shift it the other way around, that if they're wanting to have a longer fasted window, they do this having an earlier dinner or a smaller dinner, but with a caveat. If you're training later in the evening, say you're finishing your training at 8 or 9 o'clock, then I would recommend that you have a proper meal after your training and not have a small meal. So it really is context specific. And this is obviously where we come in as coaches, as we look at your lifestyle and we look at what you're doing and we start tailoring this. Right. But what we have is we have now playing with the foods that you're eating in the timing of them to get the best benefit.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's very context driven. It's not like if the context was you were just a normal person who wasn't a climber and you just wanted to have a healthy, you know, have the be the healthiest you could be, that'd be very different. But since you're a climber, you know, when are you exercising? If you exercise first thing in the morning, if you wake up at 5 a.m. and you go to the gym, then that means having carbohydrates, you know, earlier in the morning, potentially. If you're climbing in the evening, then maybe you need to have a larger meal in the evening to help with recovery and help with that session. This is now, you know, we're talking about like your diet as it currently is compared to when you exercise could be off. You know, it's probably like obviously you're still exercising, so it's probably adequate. It's not holding you back necessarily, but it's off from what its optimal could be. So this is the timing, the timing aspect of it.
Yeah. So now, like on the same, almost on the same level, and they can flip flop, is that like earlier I mentioned that maybe now we can start looking at some numbers. And I think Brian would probably agree with this one, is that I think we have enough data to say that there is a protein intake that can really be easily, you can easily optimize your health and your recovery by optimizing your protein intake. Mm-hmm. And this does come into a little bit more of a numbers. So what we're looking at is that if you go back and listen to our protein podcast, you'll hear a lot of detail about this. But what we know is that there is a threshold of the amount of protein that will trigger the recovery and growth of your muscles. And this works out, depending on your age and your sex, from about 20 grams of protein to up to about 40, 50 grams of protein. What I recommend to people is basically if you shoot for about 30 grams of protein per meal, this is probably going to be adequate and optimal to provide enough protein in a dose to trigger everything we talk about in the protein podcast. Yeah. And just for some context, you're probably already doing this. So a can of tuna fish, I think, is like 28 grams of protein. A small can of sardines is like 25 grams of protein. A chicken breast is about anything from about 35 to 40 grams of protein. Legumes and tofu and things like that are going to be slightly lower. So you just have to eat a larger portion of them. But this is information that you can easily find online or using a kind of calorie counter app. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're wanting to do is that if you can have roughly, say, 25 to 30 grams of protein at each of your meals, which is generally going to be probably 3 to 5, depending on how big you are, and your hunger is obviously going to dictate this as well. Mm. Here we have some numbers, but it's not a difficult thing to manage in terms of a macronutrient goal without the mathematics.
Right. Yeah. And even like to touch briefly on timing, like this could be just one part of your timing as well. Like, you know, when we're talking about protein and really like you want to understand more about, you know, the dynamics behind our recommendations, go back and listen to the protein episode. I don't think there's a terrible need to rehash too much of it here. But basically, you know, you want to get that 20 to 30 grams more if you're older. And you want to get it every few hours, at least. Not at least. You want to get it every few hours. That's the spacing. If you get it in shorter time spans, then you're just not going to get as much benefit out of it. Or if you get all of it in one meal, you're not going to get as much out of it. So if you're the type of person who's, you know, eating breakfast and their breakfast is like a bowl of oatmeal or a piece of fruit, so there's not really any protein in that. So timing for you, depending on your diet, might mean looking at your diet, looking at your meals and saying, okay, well, I'm not actually eating protein during these meals. I should probably add some to them. And now your timing, yes, you're timing a specific macronutrient. But I don't quite classify that small bit anyway as a macronutrient goal because it's more about timing. It's about like looking at a single meal and saying, my breakfast is really inadequate in protein. It means that I'm only really getting 2 doses of protein per day. I can gain a benefit by adding that third one in during breakfast and finding a way to make that a possibility, whether, you know, you're going to add some eggs or a glass of milk or some beans or, you know, just a protein shake or whatever is going to make that work for you.
Exactly. And, you know, now it goes back again to the initial, the foundation of the pyramid. So before I said you can have a piece of fruit or something, before your training and in your training, your next change can be having a portion of protein right after your training. So you've set yourself your normal meal intake and you're like, okay, I want to make a change. Right. So I'm going to have a piece of fruit before I train and I'm going to have maybe a protein shake or a small protein meal, with say some carbs after I train. Straight away, you've made very simple changes without any mathematics, and you can now see yourself on your weight trend, and you just scale up from there. And it will basically be more protein and more carbs, or maybe some more fats and things like that. So here you have an example of how these things are all overlapping, but the priority is still there, getting the energy intake. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the nutrients and the macro goals. So Brian, let's dig a little bit deeper then into what you would classify then as your kind of macro goals.
Yeah. So when I think about macro goals, now I'm looking at, you know, where are the calories in your diet coming from? So for something like protein, protein is a pretty static goal, you know, because we only want a certain amount. Like if you get 60 grams of protein in a meal, you're not getting much more benefit from it, if any, than if you were to get 30. So we're really talking about carbohydrates and fat. So the change here is maybe right now, like I said, maybe your diet's very, very fat-based. You're eating a lot of nuts and seeds and maybe fatty cuts of meat, eggs, whatever. And we want to shift that. So we want to start shifting it. In this case, you know, for Tom and I think both of us would be making the shift just more towards carbohydrate.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I thought I'd let you get a word in.
Okay, yeah. So that's exactly it. Is that yeah? The protein is going to basically scale up in terms of general recommendations. What we might do is if we notice that someone is eating a huge amount of protein, then we might change that. But most of the time is that we really are manipulating the carbohydrates. And again, we're not going to go into full details of why carbohydrates are so important, but this is where we're just looking at saying, okay, so this person is weight stable now. What is the kind of the ratio of the foods that they're eating? And say somebody is weight stable and they're eating a kind of low carbohydrate, high fat diet. Most of the time, we're probably going to keep the protein as it is if they've got good protein habits, which we've mentioned a moment ago. And what we would probably do is say, okay, so you're normally putting this much fat in on your plate, or you're having, you know, this much, these sorts of fats in your meal, maybe having a lot of nuts and seeds. Then what we do is we'll say, okay, can you take a little bit of the nuts and seeds away and replace it with, let's say, some starchy vegetables in your meals. Mm-hmm. And again, we then look at the scale. And surprisingly, what you tend to see with increasing carbohydrate is you will see weight will, depending on how much carbohydrate someone was eating before, will start to rise fairly quickly. But as I've said, that tends to be water weight in the most part. But what you'll also find is actually, and I've seen this with a number of clients, is that when they start increasing carbohydrate, they actually start losing weight. And the reason being is that it actually can impact hormone levels. It can also, which I probably think is the main driver, is it will actually increase your non-exercise activity, meaning that you tend to be walking around more or more active during your kind of working day. You'll also find that your training will increase almost unconsciously. You might just feel that you can pull harder, or you feel like, you know, crashing out some more pull-ups or body weight training. And this is the whole point of that, going back to that foundation of the pyramid, is if you've changed this ratio of carbohydrate to fats and your weight now is maybe going down, what you want to do is you start increasing things back in. And you keep tapering that carbohydrate up and up until you get back to this kind of steady weight. And what you'll be quite surprised about is that suddenly you're eating more carbohydrate than you have before, you're training harder, you're feeling better and you're recovering better. Sometimes the calorie intake can be quite significant. You know, it could be 300 or 400 calories more per day than what you were eating before. And this is where it becomes interesting, is that you have somebody who has been a certain weight for a very long time, eating what they do habitually. You suddenly give them, say, 300 to 400 more calories of carbohydrate per day. And incredibly, their weight has maybe drifted up by a kilo and a half because of the greater glycogen stores. But now they're sitting at a kilo and a half more weight, but they are stronger and they have more energy for their climbs. So what's happened is that you have changed the metabolism of your body. You have shifted a gear up and you're actually now providing yourself with more and your weight is still the same, relatively speaking.
Yeah. And so, you know, when I'm working with a client, this often for me anyway, it often goes hand in hand. The changing of the macronutrient ratios goes hand in hand with this the first base, which is, you know, just increasing calories. So very rarely, like most of the clients I see don't have super high fat diets. And when they do and you change them, it's always like this radical change. But more often, like the amount of fat they're eating is perfectly reasonable. And I'm not going to change that. I'm not going to tell them, okay, stop eating so many nuts and seeds. You're going crazy on those. I need you to pull back. But what does happen is I see their diet. I see that they can eat some more. And I suggest that they get those calories from carbohydrate sources. And so we start tweaking the calories, and simultaneously, also tweaking their macronutrient ratios just by adding more calories in the form of carbohydrates. You know, that's, we're covering both those goals at the same time in that way.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think I have one person who I've worked with who had a greater, so my, the, almost every client that I've worked with has an average fat intake without them even trying between 60 and 80 grams a day.
Yeah, that's
Yeah, it's amazing actually that it just sits at this amount without trying. The only time I ever see a difference in that is when somebody comes to me and they're like, "Oh, I've been eating a ketogenic diet for how many years? Right. You know, I'd like to try something different." And then obviously it's going to be like 100, 120 grams of fat a day. So yeah, it's only those people that I tend to pull down the fat, or obviously with weight loss clients, I'm trying to pull down the fat so that we can fit in maybe more protein or something like that. So here we've given you some practical application there without you actually even having to do much maths at all. So you should feel empowered by that you can make a dramatic change in your sports nutrition, your climbing nutrition, without you having to resort to actually doing any mathematics at all. You're just changing habits. You're putting things in. Mm-hmm. You're using, and I really encourage clients to use food items that are common, because if you eat an extra avocado every day, you're eating something that is repeatable,
right?
It doesn't need to be precise. If you're having an extra cup of, so when I ask clients to do starches like rice, I ask them to measure out dry. So I say, take a volume cup of dry basmati rice and cook that and have that as your meal. If we need to change that, this is very easy. I say 3/4 cup or 1.5 cups, mm-hmm. right? This is something that they can repeat. And it also makes it much easier for you, because say you cook yourself at the beginning of in the evening for the next day, you cook yourself two cups of uncooked basmati rice and you cook it up and you eat that whole thing of rice by the end of the next day, then you know you have a fixed amount of carbohydrate that you're having without even knowing how much carbohydrate that actually is.
Right.
And then you can scale that by changing it or adding to it by, say, having some more fruit or having some raisins in there or whatever. So make it easier for yourself. You really don't need the numbers to have really good optimal diet. The only time that numbers really make a big difference is probably when someone is hitting a plateau with fat loss.
Yeah.
Because then you need a level of tightness and control to understand, okay, we're looking at the habits of someone and for some reason their weight isn't going down. So like, okay, where is this food coming in? And then you find out they're putting a little bit too many, you know, they're snacking on nuts, or they're putting a little bit too much butter somewhere, or, you know, they're having some sweets over the weekend that they didn't report or something like that. So that's really the kind of the bread and butter of it. So you've now got a level 4, which again could cross over to the previous two levels. So in the article, Brian, you call it periodize your diet to your training.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, for me, this is the pinnacle, not as in the pinnacle is in you can't really do anything beyond this, I guess. As far as like how much of an impact this is going to have on your performance compared to the other steps, it's going to have a far, far smaller amount. The other steps are far more critical. And in fact, in this final step of periodizing your diet, it requires you to have knowledge of all the other three things that we've talked about. So I want to make sure that though, for you, is this the pinnacle for what you're talking about as well, Tom? Because if there's something else that you would do before we start talking about periodizing diet to training, then we should probably talk about that first.
No, I think, no, because the only thing that I would bring in somewhere here is I would talk about supplementation.
Right. Yeah. We actually haven't. That's true. We haven't talked about supplementation.
Mm-hmm. But I think in a general sense, I think the only time I bring a supplement in which I still don't classify as a supplement, would be something like a whey protein or a plant protein supplement. And all that is that it's for somebody who's wanting to try and optimize that protein per meal. Mm-hmm. Something like a protein supplement becomes a very easy thing to take with them to training or to have at breakfast to help their porridge be better. So that's why I don't really classify protein as a supplement as such, but rather as an easy way of getting protein.
Yeah.
But I think, I think after I would then make like the cherry on the top of this periodize your diet to training being these ergogenic aid type or.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would put them a little bit below the periodization, but.
Okay.
I feel like they are something extra. And for some of them, like really, we're just talking about like adding them to, you know, a protein shake or like a bowl of oatmeal or just a cup of water. It's not necessarily that hard. But they also don't, they're not going to make as big of a difference as some of these other, you know, increasing your calories is going to have a bigger difference than taking creatine or beta-alanine. Taking supplements is easy. It just doesn't necessarily do a lot. And sometimes, like in the case of beta-alanine, if you don't like that paresthesia feeling, then it could be hard in the sense that you don't really want to take it, but you know there's a benefit, but you don't like the way it makes you feel. So you might have to like mentally force yourself to do it. I guess I would put that somewhere in the middle as well.
Okay, so I tell you why I tend to, when I work with clients who, I mean, a lot of clients I have already take supplements. So that normally is not an issue anyway, because then we're scaling things up.
Right.
The reason, say I had someone who came to me who doesn't take any supplements at all, because they haven't really thought about it, is that the reason that I would leave supplements to the very, very end is that I want to empower people to understand the smallest change that they're making and noticing the difference. So if I'm getting someone to eat more, they're going to notice something different. If they then start having that more being made up of more carbohydrate, they're going to notice a difference. And we haven't muddied the waters of anything, because along the way, they're being empowered and you're seeing, oh, okay, so this is where I was doing before. Now I'm eating more and this is what I'm doing. Now I'm eating more carbohydrate. Oh, look where I am. Now I'm putting the carbohydrates in the right place. And protein after training, for instance, oh, look how well I'm doing in terms of recovery. Once you have that in place and you have this kind of this big going up the pyramid of efficacy without too much trouble, now we start saying, okay, so right, if I introduce creatine into this, oh, wow, okay, now creatine, I can actually see there's a difference, a added benefit of having creatine. Whereas if someone comes in and they haven't really got their carbohydrate or their total calories in place, but they take in creatine or even something like caffeine around training, it can also muddy really what is having the effect.
Yeah.
Because you can be on a diet and put caffeine before your training and your training will be fantastic for a while. But that's really, you know, we're then mucking around with actually what is important here. And I think this actually is the reason why Brian wrote this article and why we wanted to do the podcast is that unfortunately, people tend to look at supplements as the first thing they want to change.
Right.
So they suddenly go from a kind of a suboptimal diet to a suboptimal diet with, say, creatine and some pre-workout supplement. And they're like, oh, yeah, I feel really great. But it's not sustainable. And it's a pretty upside-down way of doing things.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. That's a completely fair way to categorize it. Yeah, it does muddy the water some. You're not going to be able to discern, you know, what is making a difference or how big of a difference those things are making. Not that, you know, you're going to be able to quantify these things in a, you know, an objective way necessarily anyway, but it is going to make it, if you just do everything at once, if you lump everything together, then it could obscure what the true priorities are. You know, and so, yeah, if you're working with somebody like me or Tom and you do everything and then, you know, you inevitably, you know, at some point you're not going to pay us to continue working with you, most likely.
Sure.
I mean, I guess
you can if you want to, of course,
have that patron, but but you know, for me anyway, I want to help people understand, and it sounds like Tom as well. We want to help you understand what it is that's important, and yeah, supplements are not the biggest change that you should be making, nor the place where you should be focusing your energy. They are an easy change, but they're not going to be the change that changes your life. Okay.
That sounds quite profound. The change that changes your life. Anyway, so let's talk about your, what do you call it? Diet periods.
Yeah. So, I mean, this, I guess, you know, most of you are probably familiar with periodizing your training. Like, you're not going to do the same training week after week, year after year, because we all understand that at some point you're going to plateau. Your muscles will stop adapting. You're going to stop improving. You've got to periodize what you're doing in order to continue improving. And this goes hand in hand with that to a certain extent. But I'd say that in this case, what we're talking more about is, like, if you're a professional climber, or if you do a lot of comps, and you know, or if there's like a specific season, maybe that like you live in an area and there's just like a crag that you love going to that is only really in season for, you know, a brief window of time, then you're going to be periodizing what you're doing training wise throughout your year, depending on what your goal is. You know, so you're going to be training in the months before those comps or before, you know, open season. And then during that season itself, you're going to be, you know, maybe the training's dialed down, but instead you're, you know, really focused on going and performing. Like it's this performance mindset of, you know, making sure you can get the most climbing in, or whatever the goal is going to be in that case. And then afterwards there might be a decompression period where you are resting a lot and just recovering before the whole cycle starts again. There's obviously possibility for different types even within those, and you know, in other part times that you're periodizing what you're doing for that as well. So for a lot of us, this isn't really a critical aspect of, you know, like we might have some loose scheduling, right? But it's not like we're concentrating on this, and that, you know, like I train, you know, I go to the gym basically throughout the year just because I enjoy climbing, and then I'll climb outside when I can climb outside. But I don't, where I, you know, what my priorities as a climber, for me, that a very deep level of training specification and periodization isn't that important. So I'm not really periodizing my nutrition around my training for that reason. What we're talking about with nutrition periodization now is if you are periodizing your training, we want to make sure that you are also periodizing your nutrition to that training. So when you are training hard, you need to follow a diet that is fully supporting that. When you are resting, you need to, you know, have a diet that details that. If you're trying to lose weight, you know, perhaps in the months before starting, you know, a training phase, then you need to periodize your diet for that. That's what periodizing your diet to your training is.
Yeah, exactly. Quite simply, on the most basic level, we can think of periodization being this big kind of blocks of time that you're doing preparation, as Brian said. But I do periodization with people on a weekly basis, and the simplest thing is I ask people to consume more carbohydrate when their training or their performance involves a kind of power strength goal. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if somebody has a day where they just do cardio, right? It could be rowing or running or something, and they're not really doing anything that requires them to measure any time. They're not pushing for a goal. It's not a performance thing. It's just they're just, you know, turning over the legs or the arms or whatever. Then I generally ask people to limit the carbohydrate there because it's just not needed. And it may allow them a little bit of room in terms of keeping energy balance. It may provide a little bit of fat loss. It really depends on the goal. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, what I'm saying is that you periodizing, and it really is periodizing carbohydrates. The only thing I really periodize.
Yeah, that's true.
is saying when you're doing power strength training, when you're trying to squeeze the best out of your body, when you're trying to recover the best that you can and support that training output, or you're trying to push the envelope, then that's where you are pushing the carbohydrate envelope. And then say, well, here's an example. Say that you get sick or something, or you're going on holiday or something like that, then you're going to be reducing that food volume and mainly carbohydrate volume to match what you're doing. So these are the strategies that I implement with people much later on in the program, because we want to get someone to have this base level of nutrition in place. Mm-hmm. But then this starts being the kind of the polish, the tweaking on things.
Right.
And this also goes into, for instance, when I've worked with people who are doing big kind of, you know, climbing tours, then we're going to periodize their nutrition around that. And it'd be quite specific. You know, if they're doing big multi-pitch stuff, they can't carry loads of food up. So we get very periodized leading up to the trip, and we periodize where in the day that they're having the food. And we also use supplements that I would. So for instance, I used tart cherry to help someone recover better during this kind of these tours. But they won't use tart cherry when they're doing the normal training, because as we've mentioned in the recovery podcasts, that this can interfere with the training adaptation. So we're periodizing a supplement there to maximize their recovery during their trip. But once they come off that trip, they're probably going to reduce their food down a little bit and certainly take away a supplement like that. So there's an example of periodizing diet to match the output. I've got an example today. Somebody asked me, they're doing some strength testing. So they asked how best I could do that. And I got a little bit specific with them and said, because they've got 2 days off, so they're going to be training on Friday night. And they asked me what they should do with their carbohydrate. And so I said, I want them to have carbohydrate after their training on Friday night. And on Saturday, when it is their rest day, I've asked them to have their high carbohydrate targets that I've given them. And the reason for that is I really want to maximize their glycogen. But then on the Sunday, which is also another rest day, I've asked them to have my lower carbohydrate intake target, because they don't need that, and also to shift the carbohydrate to the beginning of the day, so they have most of the day without big glucose spikes, which may help reduce inflammation. And then on the Monday, they're doing their strength training. So it's things like weighted pull-up tests and bench press and all this sort of stuff. I'm asking them to have a good carbohydrate breakfast that's going to have more fruit and other starchy carbs to maximize their liver glycogen, then have some periodized carbohydrates just before they do the testing. And within the testing, I've also asked them to increase creatine during these 3 days leading up to the testing. So here we have some specific interventions in a periodized fashion to try and maximize what they're specifically doing, which is on the Monday. Now, there's many different things you can do like this.
Right.
And this is obviously why you work with a coach, is that you're outsourcing this thinking to us.
Right.
And we find it interesting, probably more interesting than you do. So here you can see that the diet periodization becomes far more complicated.
Yeah.
And that's why it's the smallest little thing. Because the main thing is that if you are fiddling around with periodization of your carbohydrate intake and doing train low, sleep low days, and you haven't even got the base of your pyramid, or you have no idea what your basal amount of food is, then you've put the cart before the horse, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that kind of in a broad sense, we can look at all of these stages as how much of a habitual change do you have to make. You know, at the very base, you're making just one fairly simple habit change, just eating more food. But by the time you get to this top, like the change that you're making is a change to your habits on, you know, if not a month to month basis, or if not a week to week basis, then like a month to month, like you're changing a lot. Yeah. And that takes, you know, not only like if you're doing that by yourself, then that takes you actually thinking about it and working on it and creating this plan, which is work, but then even implementing it, you know, like even for our clients, if we're doing all this work for them, that still doesn't necessarily make it easy because it's something that they have to think about, you know, every day, because they're not habits anymore. If you're changing something that often, it's very hard for them to become habitual. Habits are things that we do without thinking. And, you know, this is what, you know, as we'll talk about weight loss, is what makes weight loss so hard. You know, if weight loss was just as easy as, if changing habits was easy, then weight loss would be easy. But changing habits is hard. And so when you're talking about periodizing your diet or your training or doing any of these really, you know, high level things that require constant habit change or, you know, a lack of habits to kind of pull your weight along absentmindedly, it's challenging, it's difficult. And yeah, will you get something out of it? You know, if you can't focus on that, all of that, absolutely, especially if you've taken care of all of the other aspects of it. But it's work, and it's not necessarily work that you want to put in or have the, you know, I don't want to say don't have the capacity to put in. You're weak. You can't do it. I don't mean that. I just mean like, you know, not all of us want to do that. And it's perfectly okay if you don't want to do that. You can get a lot of benefit still just by focusing on the earlier steps, the earlier stages, bases.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I'm telling you now that if you took two climbers and the one started to fiddle around with the top of the pyramid to try and squeeze out as much performance as they can versus someone who's just simply eats more food, I'm telling you now, the person who eats more food is going to do better than the other person.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's the reason that we put them in terms of this priority is because these are what's driving the most change in your life. And remember as well is that if you're eating more food, right, we're not just talking about increasing the amount of energy that you're having. You're actually increasing, if you're choosing whole foods, you're increasing the amount of minerals and vitamins, polyphenols. These are all going to scale up. So this is the big thing, is that by increasing the amount of whole foods that you're having in your diet, rather than say drinking some sort of sports drink as you're increasing calories, which can be useful. But if you're suddenly eating more fruit and veg per day, or having a big salad with fresh salad vegetables with your dinner, which you didn't do before, you are scaling up your nutrition and your recovery and your health, and all of these things are going to improve. Plus you get the benefit of obviously increasing your energy intake as well. So keep that in mind. We're not saying to up your energy intake, start eating more biscuits and things. Those can be useful, and I encourage them, but rather eat more food. You now have the opportunity to actually seeing how much food you can put in your body. It's actually quite exciting when you suddenly realize that. And for some people, you know what it might be, and this is where it can be very useful, is that for somebody, it might simply be having some nuts, which they don't normally eat. Yeah. And straight away, you're going to start improving a number of things by having these so-called healthy fats. Plus, you're going to get more things like magnesium and some extra zinc and things like that. Mm-hmm. Or, for instance, what I recommend to people is to have 2 or 3 cans of sardines per week. And this is something that I do myself, is that while I'm cooking my dinner, I yank a can out of the fridge. I like them cold, and literally eat the sardines out of the can while I'm cooking my dinner.
We've got a lot of great advice in this episode, but feel free to ignore that cold sardine piece. I don't know about that. That's weird.
What? No, I like it. Because if you keep them in the fridge, they're not so smelly, fishy.
Room temperature, so all the way.
Really? Oh well, there we go.
I don't know. I guess I've never thought about it. Honestly, I've never played with the temperature of my canned fish. I might try it out. It could be okay.
Yeah, I actually did the habit because I used to have them at work, yeah. And if they're room temperature, they tend to smell. So, not that I would eat sardines in the actual office, but you know, the shared kitchen would end up smelling like sardines.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, I just find it more palatable that way. But straight away, like eating a can of sardines gives you an extra 25 grams of protein and about, I think it's almost 2 grams of omega-3.
Yeah.
So they're really good. Plus some calcium as well from the bones. So that's a good little habit. Right. So I think that is it in a general sense.
Yeah.
I'm gonna very quickly run through the bullet points that I have here. So what I do is as number one is have a look at your lifestyle factors. So have a look at your food choices, have a look at your sleep schedule, and have a look at your stress, right? This is just your general health stuff. Have a look at that and see if you can optimize that a little bit better. These are not difficult things, right? Certainly the food choices is an easy one, right? If you're not eating whole foods, then this is where you would start, right? The next thing is look at your baseline intake of food, right? So let's leave mass out of this. So you look at what you currently eat, and you weigh yourself every day and you put that in a spreadsheet and then you look at a trend line. If your weight is not changing, then just eat more whole foods. If your weight starts going up, just watch that for say a week or 2 weeks. And if it starts tapering down or plateauing again, then add a little bit more. And if it starts creeping up again, then take a little bit away and find where you're sitting in this general weight stable. It's not going to sit perfectly, but what you don't want is your weight to be creeping up, you know, half a kilo every week. Right. Then you're eating too much. While you're doing this, keep a journal of how you're feeling, what your mood is like, how your sleep is like, what your training is like, what your recovery is like. These things are going to be encouraging for you and empowering to help you stay the track and start seeing. Because one thing, and I will stress this, is that one of the things I notice with a lot of climbers is I keep having to say, just trust me. Because what they do is they start seeing their weight creep up a little bit, certainly with the carbohydrates. And I say, just trust me, it will basically balance out. And it eventually does. And they're like, oh, great, I feel so good. And I'm training much better and recovering. And I'm like, yeah, I know. That's how it works. Once you've done that, you found that, then you start looking at how you can more optimize what you're eating. So like we said, getting the protein at every meal, which is roughly 25 to 30 grams of protein per meal, really is a minimum. That's the first number that you start playing with. You're already going to be scaling up your carbohydrate intake anyway, so your ratio is going to be changing there. So that's the kind of the same thing. And then the next thing is maybe looking at a bit of strategy. On the days that you're not doing your training, you're not doing your resistance training, you're either a recovery day or maybe just a pure cardio day, you can knock out some of those carbohydrates. You know, maybe you can have a little bit more fat if you like that. You know, you can start changing your meals so you have a bit of variety with that. And then I would then say the next thing would be having a look at maybe whether or not supplementation can benefit you in specific sense, and you know, refer you back to our supplement podcast for which supplements we think are the most beneficial for optimizing climbing performance. And then I have a big thing here that I just say, and I really think this is make as few changes as possible at the same time, because I really think that a lot of habits.
If you can make zero changes, perfect.
make a change and note what happens when you make that change.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, what is exciting is when you make a change and you notice a difference, a positive difference, and then you know really what you did, right?
Yeah.
And then that's good because you will feel empowered. And I'll keep saying this word empowered. And the reason I say it a lot is because, you cannot outsource your control or your nutrition to some calorie counting app, because it's not good. It's gonna make, it's a hassle. It doesn't actually teach you anything. Calorie counting apps, I use them with my clients, but I use them as a way for them to keep in check or to understand what their meal looks like. And once they understand what their meal looks like, I then say to them, okay, now you have a recipe. So you start building up this bank of things that you know roughly what the calorie content is, or rather protein carb content is. I mean, this is the reason why we did the podcast in the first place, was to empower you guys, so that you can actually go away and do this stuff yourself and not need to do, you know, spend hours researching it all. That's it. I think that's our climbing nutrition priority pyramid.
Yeah. That's start from the base, do the big things first, and you get those things down and you have the time, the willpower, the mental effort that you can put in, then, you know, feel free to take it as far up as you can. Just know that, you know, you're going to start getting diminishing returns and it could be worthwhile for you, you know, for you and your goals, or it could not be. But if you do the big things, then you're going to get most of it, you know, most of the benefit out of it. Calories first, timing and macronutrients, you know, as a, you know, a follow-up, periodizing your nutrition, and yeah, supplements. Supplements will help a small amount.
Cool. Okay. This is like, I think this may be our shortest podcast ever.
I think we're getting more efficient at talking with each other.
maybe.
Or choosing topics that are bite-sized.
Also, we did speak for like almost an hour before we even started.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. So, okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a look at some questions that I asked. I asked on my Instagram, just some questions anyone has had. And I've got one from Red Dog Climbing Company. And they said, pre and post workout powders, worth a shit or not?
I mean, let's eliminate post workout powders right now, because there's not really, I feel like there's not really such a thing as a post workout powder, unless you consider like powdered meals a post workout powder. There's nothing like after
protein
workout,
and carbs,
like maybe. There's nothing that does anything other than calories. And even those are, you know, like you don't need to. They don't do anything magical. They just act as food. Pre-workout, there's not really much that's going to do a lot specifically pre-workout either. There's caffeine, and there's, you know, like potentially some. I mean, you know, I've talked about citrulline malate before, and my view on that has gone down because the data as it keeps coming in just doesn't seem to be that it's really all that beneficial. But you know, ostensibly it's a nitric oxide booster, but it just doesn't seem to be that effective. So my view on that has come down. Caffeine is really the only thing that we can powder that I would say we know has at least some benefit to it. And I don't really, I guess if it comes prepackaged from a company, it's probably fine. But otherwise, I don't really recommend people take caffeine in a powder form just because it's also highly dangerous. Like if you mismeasure, whether because you're not paying attention or, you know, for whatever the reason, it can be deadly. Like it doesn't happen often, obviously, but, if you really want to take caffeine before a workout and you're not going to drink coffee or tea, just get it in a pill form at least, because you can't accidentally, you're not going to accidentally take 10 pills
Or I'll just have like a, I mean, you get a lot of caffeine drinks now.
Right, right. You know, I would usually, yeah, caffeine is all kind of as arbitrary because if you like caffeine, hopefully I'd rather you just drink it in, you know, a pleasurable form like coffee or tea. It's a very pleasurable drug to, you know, in its intake method, you can, you know, really enjoy a nice cup of coffee. It's better off doing that. But so I would say no, not worthwhile.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so almost all pre-workout tubs that you'll see in sports nutrition or nutrition stores tend to have the same ingredients at varying amounts. Mm-hmm. So caffeine normally comes in at about, I think it's like about 200 to 300 milligrams of caffeine, which is normally the dose that we see in research papers to show a significant effect. To put it into context, a Red Bull, I think, is 80 milligrams of caffeine, and an espresso is like maybe 60.
I think it's like 40 to 45 per shot.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there we go. So, yeah, so a double espresso and a can of Red Bull is probably fairly similar. So if you can imagine how you feel drinking a double espresso or a can of Red Bull, and then you have 200 milligrams rather than 80 milligrams.
Triple that.
You're going to probably feel that. And so 99% of the benefit or the so-called feeling that you're getting from your pre-workout is the caffeine. Like that's it. It doesn't matter what else is in it. That's what you're feeling, and that's what you're paying whatever £32 for.
Yep.
What you'll also find in pre-workouts is what Brian mentioned, which is citrulline and malate.
Or sometimes arginine.
Yeah, and that's really just to try and so-called dilate your blood vessels to move your blood further around. But the research on this is not actually that good. What seems to be actually better for that, plus some other benefits, is beetroot. So you can take beetroot shots. So if you're looking for that effect, then potentially beetroot shots, those shots of beetroot, probably a better way of doing it. Or eating a lot of spinach, maybe.
A ton of bacon, something cured.
Just keep them away from the bacon. But basically, anything that increases your nitrates. But yeah, I'd probably go for like, if you're going to do like an endurance session, then probably like a big plate of spinach and beetroot an hour before you do your training might be beneficial. What else you'll find in pre-workouts is creatine sometimes, which is a waste. But the main one is beta-alanine, which if you listen to our supplement podcast, we say is beneficial, certainly. But there is no reason to take it immediately before your training.
Beneficial. They're beneficial if you take them chronically over long term and boost your intramuscular stores. You don't get any benefit out of them by taking them before a workout.
No. And also this is where it becomes a bit stupid, is that you're paying for a mixed supplement. So the doses of, say, beta-alanine that you're getting per scoop from your pre-workout might even be suboptimal. Yeah. So if the only way you're getting beta-alanine is from, you know, 3 grams that you get in a scoop because it contains citrulline, malate, arginine, and caffeine, then you've kind of wasted your money because you might as well just buy yourself a tub of beta-alanine and taking 5 grams every day, which is a recommended dose. Same with creatine. And you'll save your money on this mixed thing. I never recommend mixed supplements to anybody, mainly because you can't control it.
Right.
So I think
That's pretty amazing. You pay a surcharge for the mixing and you get less control. So it is a little bit strange. There's a certain amount of convenience, like, you know, you probably would take creatine and beta alanine at the same time, but you can just buy them separately and mix them in the ratio that you personally want. That would be a better way to go about that if you absolutely have to have a mixed supplement, so you only need to measure it once instead of, you know, taking 2 measuring spoons and measuring twice.
Yeah. And like we say, almost all the ingredients in a pre-workout is probably going to better be taken, you know, at the end of the day.
Right.
So for instance, I take beta-alanine, creatine, and taurine most evenings, just habitually, if I remember. Yeah. But I have them as separate packages, and you know, I think I probably got about 3 kilos of the stuff for, I don't know, 30 quid.
So you know, if you get them through a bulk manufacturer, you know, through a smaller company.
So my verdict on that is, I honestly think pre-workouts are, they're harmless, really, apart from, say, the caffeine dose. Now, obviously, if you're going to take a pre-workout, be aware that it's most likely going to contain caffeine. Yep. And if you're taking it at like 8 o'clock at night,
you're going to feel it.
Like four, like two double espressos of caffeine before you go to bed is probably not a great idea. Yeah. So just be wary of that. What have we got here? Any other question? I did see another one. Where did that go? Did it come up on my phone? Why is it? Oh, here we are. Oh, here we are. So this is from okay, so Shauna Ella NV says, should protein intake be standardized at 25 grams per meal snack, or is it weight-based? I thought I'd read on your website 25 to 45 grams per meal, but I thought I recalled from Protein Podcast that it was about 25 grams for anyone training. Thanks so much for your podcast and website, by the way. Both are brilliant. I think we've answered that already. Yeah. So that's been done. She says, also, is it bad to eat a lot of dairy? As a pescatarian, I tend to end up eating a lot of yogurt and milk and whey to make up my protein.
That's kind of a,
what do you think, Brian?
Big picture nutrition epidemiological question that I don't think we have a great answer to. I mean, it's like I'm just not going to tread into the philosophical or ethical questions, because if you're opposed to consuming dairy, then you know there's clearly reasons why you might be. So let's not tread into those waters. As far as like health goes, let me pull up this article fast. I wrote an article that kind of looked at different protein sources and their effects on cancer, because somebody had asked me a question, and this is probably the only question that we're really talking about in this case. Like, does the protein from dairy actually have an impact on our long-term health? Because like the other things in it, you know, like calcium, there's no problem with getting a ton of calcium from dairy. You're not gonna get a dangerous amount. You know, if you're drinking full fat dairy, like calories, maybe calories are gonna play an impact, but that's something we can control. You know, like just because you're getting a lot of calories from dairy doesn't mean that you're eating too many calories. It depends on the rest of your diet. So we can just kind of eliminate that. The types of fat in it, probably not going to be that important unless, again, you have a specific health problem that is affected by certain fats. Or again, if you're overweight and these extra calories and these extra fats are going to impact some of your, biomarkers. So dairy is high in leucine. Dairy, you know, consistently raises IGF-1, which is associated with overall cancer risk and mortality, at least in certain age ranges. So this is where it's very tangled. Like, we don't have a clear answer, which is part of the problem. People want a clear answer, but all we can say is, well, maybe, you know, it has effect in certain things. So what I wrote on this article is, most studies on dairy find it to be mostly positive, but there is some conflicting data. Dairy may be more beneficial in terms of cardiovascular risk than cancer risk, but either way, data suggests dairy either slightly reduces all-cause mortality or has no clinically significant effect at all. Given that even when dairy is found to be beneficial, the improvement is very small, it seems fair to label dairy as a neutral protein source and not as a beneficial one. So to kind of sum that up, dairy is maybe a little good for you, maybe a little bad for you, but probably does not have a large – dairy protein, I should say, probably does not have a significant effect on your health.
Yeah. I think just to just to pick up on the IGF thing very, very briefly, this goes actually into periodized nutrition, right? If you are easiest way to think about it is when you consume a protein source that has leucine, leucine triggers anabolic pathways. This is why we talk about protein being beneficial for recovery, right? Because it has a high amount of leucine plus the other amino acids, it's going to trigger this anabolic response so that your tissue can heal. So the reason that people get a bit uppity about animal protein, which would fold in obviously dairy protein, is because it is very anabolic. It's a very useful, high quality protein because it has leucine and the whole gamut of amino acids. Where it becomes a problem is that if you don't need that anabolic response, then this is going to be an issue. So if you're a sedentary individual who is over consuming calories in general, and then you are adding in high amounts of leucine containing protein, that anabolic response is going to do what? What is going to be required to grow? And that could then potentially be tissues that you don't want to grow, and that would be maybe cancerous cells and things like that. The difference is, though, if you take an individual who is understanding where they are at energy balance because of what we just spoke about, and they're training hard and they're needing to recover, then that person can eat a lot of protein. Why? Because they are using that and they want that anabolic response. So it's not you can't throw everything out. It's a context-specific thing. This, interesting enough, as we get older, we actually require more protein. Why? Because we become kind of anabolically resistant, meaning that it actually requires more protein, more leucine to help us recover and keep our muscle tissue. And we want to keep our muscle tissue as we get older because this is going to maintain where we can sink glucose, because remember, glucose in the blood can be pulled into muscle. The less muscle you have, the less you can deal with glucose in your bloodstream. It's also going to help you with strength and a variety of other things by just having a better lean body mass to fat. So to throw out protein sources that raise IGF-1 as being bad because it's anabolic is basically missing the point. We want to be anabolic at the right time. We don't want to be anabolic at the wrong time, and vice versa. We don't want to be catabolic when we want to be anabolic.
Yeah, it's a very tangled and tough question, because when we die, each of us individually only dies of one thing. One thing kills us. And so, you know, like, obviously, like, if you could foresee what was going to kill you, like, you would take steps to try to reduce that. But when we're looking at something like IGF-1, it might raise the risk of certain problems like cancer, and specifically it raises those risks within like this time frame, this window of like, I think it's 45 to 65 years old. And the reason it raises the risk within that window is that's just kind of the time when cancers that kill, the type of cancers that kill, that's when they tend to come, right? Like they don't tend to happen when we're very young. And you know, it's, of course they do happen, and it's very sad when they do. It's sad at any time, but, you know, they tend to happen after our bodies have matured fully and then have had some time to start degrading. You know, so kind of this 45 to 65, but then past 65, IGF-1 is actually associated with longer health and more longevity, because the things that kill us more frequently after about age 65 is not cancer. It's things that rely on, you know, having a strong body, you know, so like cardiovascular risks and you know, like sarcopenia. These are things that are more positively affected by a higher IGF-1. So we see that if you have higher IGF-1 after about age 65, then you're less likely to die. And of course, it's not like when we're looking at the risk, like that 45 to 65 range, you're still less likely to die of these things that, like ischemic stroke, I think is one of them that is positively affected. Like you're less likely to have an ischemic stroke if you have a higher IGF-1 level. You're still less likely to have one in the 45 to 65 range, but most 45 to 65 year olds are not likely to have that type of stroke anyway, or a stroke in general. those tend to be found later in life. So it's just, it's hard. You're looking at all of this and it's very easy to look and say, IGF-1 raises cancer in this very small window of time. And of course, you don't want to get cancer. And if you do, you certainly don't want to die of cancer, you know, not at 45 to 65. But you can't look at that one piece and say, well, I'm just going to reduce protein across the board and, you know, avoid proteins that raise IGF-1 because you're also raising your risk at the same time of certain other potentially life-threatening events. So yeah. And beyond all this, we only have correlational data. We don't have any causative reason for why IGF-1 would actually cause these problems. And then beyond all that, we're all individuals. And so the way your body reacts to any of this is going to be different than the way, you know, the body of data suggests that it reacts on average.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And one thing I always point out with these sort of arguments is that when someone who is eating a kind of vegan diet says, well, you know, you can get enough protein on a vegan diet to grow in terms of muscles and recovery, I say, yeah, that's exactly true. And the reason that that works is because you're getting enough leucine by eating enough protein. And that leucine that you're getting from your plant protein is the same leucine that raises IGF-1.
Right, exactly.
So it's a complete moot point. If you're hyperdosing yourself with protein from plants, you're doing exactly the same thing as you are.
It's true. Yeah.
And it's all content.
I worked for someone a long time ago, you know, doing some nutrition articles and stuff, and they sold some products and, you know, they were all about the vegan proteins. I don't think they were vegans themselves, but they were all about that. And, you know, they would like link articles like, look, meat causes these increase in IGF-1 and IGF-1 is, you know, associated with shorter lifespan. And it's like, you're missing the point. Protein, high quality protein is associated with increased IGF-1. It doesn't matter where it comes from. It's our body doesn't, like, once it's goo in our stomach and intestines, our body doesn't know if it came from meat or a bean. It's, you know, there's other things in it that are going to have impacts on our health, of course, but we're just talking about amino acids, and those amino acids are what's triggering the increase in IGF-1. Nothing else, you know, aside from calories, and it's these big things. So,
yeah. I mean, I've had a number of people over the year ask me to do a full a vegan podcast, and I think we'll definitely do that. Okay, next question, another one from Alistair Johnson. He says, I'd also be interested in hearing about the effects of a micronutrient-rich diet, i.e., is there a difference between an athlete that eats a diverse diet versus one who gets all the nutrients from a supplement-type product, for example, Soylent or, I suppose, Huel?
This is another question that's a little tough to answer because it's tough to run these types of long-term studies and find the difference. If you know very much about my views, you know that I don't really support multivitamin use, and we can kind of look at something like Huel as, aside from, like, I'm not to, like, rag on, like, there's uses for these types of meal replacements, but, like, they're essentially calories with micronutrients added. So is there a benefit to a diverse diet? I would say that when we compare people with a diverse diet, like people who eat more fruits and vegetables and legumes and whole grains, epidemiologically, we can say that they tend to be healthier and live longer. Compared to, you know, if we look at data that is about people taking multivitamins, we don't see those types of benefits. We don't really know if that's because the micronutrients or if it's something else, if it's like fiber or if it's this combination of effects or if it's just kind of a glitch in the data where we know that people who eat lots of fruits and vegetables and legumes and whole grains tend to be just healthier people with healthier lifestyles and healthier habits. And maybe they're living longer because of that. Probably, you know, it's a combination of these effects. So it's a little hard to say because certainly we know that in the short term, like if you're not getting any deficiencies, it doesn't matter if your needs are being met through a healthy, diverse diet or if they're being met through a meal replacement shake like Soylent or Huel. Like in the short term, we're not going to see any difference in like physiological levels of these nutrients. And we're going to be able to declare both people to be perfectly healthy, you know, aside from whatever minor, you know, personal problems they might have. In the long term, we don't have that type of data. My own feeling, just based on what we know about multivitamins, is that probably people with a diverse diet, probably there are advantages associated with that compared to getting all of your micronutrients through a meal replacement shake or some other artificial means. But we don't actually have the data to confirm that, nor do we have a strong hypothesis as to why that is.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I think the easiest way to do it is when you're consuming whole foods, you're getting other things like polyphenols and other plant-based chemicals, which we're only really starting to understand
right.
The benefit of. You are also providing an opportunity to increase other things like variable types of fiber. I think as well is we can say that it's more difficult to overdose on, and I mean in a kind of loose sense, overdose on vitamins when you're consuming whole foods. I think, and maybe Brian will be able to tell me better, but I would assume that if you're consuming, say, 6 or 7 kiwi fruit every day, that's going to give you, who knows, like 2 grams of vitamin C, whether or not your body would actually deal with that slightly better than, say, taking a 2 gram tablet of vitamin C every day. I don't know. I think, though, I think the biggest argument really is the fact that you're going to get a whole bunch of other stuff alongside. And I think the other thing as well is it makes you multivitamins or supplements can very easily make you complacent.
Yeah.
So, for instance, it's very easy to think that, oh, I'm having a busy week, so I'm just going to have my Soylent shake every day, and it's providing everything I need. And it may be doing that. Huel is one of the few things that that I think is actually pretty good and pretty well put together. Certainly because it could provide an opportunity to have a more plant based protein source in a convenient way. The problem comes in, I think, is that you just can easily slip into just not consuming a diversity of foods. Yeah. And I think actually that's the more damaging thing is that it's a habit thing. I think Huel can be something like Huel or Soylent can be useful as a supplement, meaning that you have your diet in check and say, like we said, you wanted to increase your intake of food, perhaps you could have a Soylent shake as a fourth or fifth meal or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, they're supplements still. And, you know, like I would even say, like you said, maybe you're having a busy week. Sometimes you have a busy week, you know, and you're just like you don't have the time to devote to food. And it can be acceptable for that because it's like a week of your life. And you go back to having a normal, diverse diet when, you know, the ash has settled. That sounds really, really, I guess, dire when the dust has settled. That's the saying, not when the ash has settled. It's not Pompeii. I'm reading a book right now. It's just talking about volcanoes. I think that's where that came from.
Okay.
You know, I've got a friend who has some pretty severe stomach issues that crop up from time to time, and she just can't put down solid food. So something like that, you know, is a good way to ensure that she's going to get at least adequate nutrition for this time, and she's not going to potentially run into deficiencies. But
exactly.
yeah, food is complex. It's way more complex than we give it credit for and that we really even understand yet. I don't like going down the, like, I think there's the temptation to go down the road of, oh, well, there's things in food that we don't know yet, but once we do know them, then we can add them to Soylent and Huel and we'll make it even that much better. I guess my feeling is food is a diverse diet is more complex than we'll ever be able to distill into a single shake or a single product. You know, there's just so much going on, even like the fiber, what, you know, Tom mentioned it briefly, but like different types of fiber, different foods have different fibers in them and different nutrients, and you're going to support different gut microbiota with that. And that is going to play impact in your overall health. So it's, and then there's, you know, phytochemicals. I think tomatoes have over 10,000 different chemicals in them, most of which probably don't do anything and aren't found in nearly large enough amounts to do anything, but maybe some of them occasionally do have some small benefit that's almost impossible for us to isolate, but that in combination with all the other chemicals that we consume in our foods do have some sort of impact, you know, chronically throughout our life in a way that would be impossible to measure in the short term. Diverse diets are what we recommend.
Yeah, which I might as well, since we've got like 10 minutes before it hits the 2 hour mark. Here's a question, since it's like trending at the moment, what are your thoughts on the carnivore diet?
The carnivore diet? Oh, I guess it's trending. I've seen only a few things. I thought there was mostly talking in jest. I don't know. Don't do it. We're not carnivores. So, we didn't evolve to be carnivores. We don't get enough nutrition from meat. There's nothing unhealthy about meat. We evolved to be omnivores. We evolved to get our nutrition from a diversity of sources, and to be able to. So take advantage of that. Us and pigs and bears, man, we get to eat a wide variety of foods and enjoy them. We're not koalas who get to feast on eucalyptus leaves every day from, you know, the time they start to the day they die.
Yeah, just to say, so the people who are getting benefit from eating just meat, one of the reasons why they're having that is because of all these other things that get bundled along with plants. And it's not to say that these things are bad for us, but one of the reasons why they're good for us is because they are toxic to us.
Right.
Cause a response. So, you know, plants don't have teeth and claws, so they have chemicals. And when we eat these chemicals, we actually have a kind of immune reaction to them at various different levels, which triggers beneficial pathways being upregulated. So the most famous being broccoli or broccoli sprouts, mm-hmm. And cancer. So this is why for some people, if they are in a very unhealthy position for whatever reason, narrowing their food down to a very, very restricted diet can be beneficial. And it can impact things like if you have an overabundance of a certain type of bacteria, then limiting the amount of fibers that you're coming in are going to be beneficial. That's why you have FODMAP diets and all this sort of stuff. So I think the real reason that a carnivore diet is probably helping a number of people who are doing it is, one, it's highly restrictive. Yeah. Meat is very benign, I think, in terms of its impact on things like autoimmune conditions and things like that. People are losing weight, and the reason they're losing weight is because they're not eating very much, and there's only so much meat you can eat. Your protein intake is going up. The quality of your protein intake is going up, so that's having a beneficial effect. I don't think it's anything magical about the meat. It might be the exclusion of certain things that are triggering gut dysbiosis, like types of fibers. It's forcing you to kick out poorer foods, because like the same as paleo, it's the same as vegan diet, it's the same as any diet that has restriction. The benefit is not necessarily the diet, but rather
invent the all meat cookies and crisps, we can guarantee that the health of these people will start going down again.
Yeah, that's what happened with paleo, exactly. Right? Paleo was cool, and then they had paleo snack foods.
Yeah, the moment you see like paleo friendly cake is like, yeah, well, I hope the people looking at this aren't saying, look, it's so much healthier than this other cake. It's not. It's cake is cake. Enjoy cake.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think on an environmental level, getting everybody to eat just meat is probably not a great idea.
Definitely
unless you're
not.
Buying a whole cow.
Definitely.
Yeah. If you're buying a whole cow, then I think, you know, more power to you. I think that's a much better way to do it. Anyway, now we are rambling. But I wanted to use the time up because, I mean, we've got to use the time up. People have an expectation. Yeah. Now, I've got a review. So we have 13 ratings on the Climb site, and 13 people can't be wrong. I don't know if I read this one, the last one, but I'm going to read it again. And it says, this is from Alfie Jameson. And we got 5 stars for this. He says, very informative and refreshingly down to earth in an industry so caught up in the latest fad or extreme diets. I've gained new knowledge every time I've listened. For me, the tangents just add more quality content and a chance to understand the topics even further. Thank you for all the content you guys have put out there.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alfie.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, no, that's really appreciate that. Please pop over to iTunes and rate the podcast if you like it. It's good. It's encouraging for us. I spoke to Brian before and said that in 2019, I'm hoping to try and move the podcast to a different platform and potentially do something with a site that's going to allow a kind of ask us anything page, which where people can up and down vote questions, and also be able to ask questions directly on the podcast. Yeah. The other thing I would like to do is find the time to put some better show notes in. When we first started, I used to actually listen to all the podcasts and write in time-stamped show notes. But that's long. That's like for a 2-hour podcast, it's like 3 hours of work. That might be something that I can relook at. The other thing I will do is I have some audio engineering stuff now, a service, so I may go back and rerun podcasts through this to get the audio quality better before I move it to the new platform. All of this stuff takes a lot of time. So if there's somebody out there who would like to help with this as a kind of a thank you, then, you know, get in contact. I can't imagine we'd be able to pay you much because we don't make any money off this. In fact, it costs us money. But if you want to do that,
it's the worst money making venture I've ever engaged in.
It is very true. Which brings me to another point. I mean, Brian and I have not, we don't have any sponsorship on this. And I think we probably want to keep it that way. Because it just will stop us from having any bias and we're allowed to talk how we like about certain topics. I would encourage you to visit climbingnutrition.com because Brian has a Patreon offer there where he will produce, where he does produce other content, which is only accessible for patrons. So I would encourage you, even if it's, you know, just a couple of quid a month, dollars a month, you know, a cup of coffee or something. That's always good for him. Whether or not we do something similar for this podcast, I don't know. Maybe I should have done that before I recorded this evening and created a PayPal page or something.
I mean, that's something we should figure out in the new year. I guess the main thing that's holding me back, and you know, maybe other people. I need to research it, but maybe if other people know something about it, is Tom and I are citizens of different countries, if we were both U.S. citizens, I know exactly how to, you know, get together an LLC and, you know, get taxes and everything resolved and, you know, make sure that everything's above board. I don't know how to do that when I'm working with, you know, one of my former colonial overseers.
Nice. Well,
I don't know how to pay taxes to the queen.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose there's a way that you guys can gift us money, and that doesn't get declared as tax. I have no idea. This is not something I thought about. If there are people out there who want to throw thousands of pounds at us because we're nice people, please get in touch. I have plenty of things I can do with that money.
Yeah, it's true.
It's true. If you, and also, maybe we should put an address. If you would like to send us gifts, you know, Christmas hampers, climbing gear. Now, the problem is that obviously we've got to be careful with what we take, and because it would maybe be looked at as a bribe. But I think, you know, certainly for Brian, some sort of beard oil would be good.
Yes, I need to keep,
if there's any beard oil,
keep this moist, you know, when I'm away from the sea anyway.
Probably I could probably buy some more shirts. You've got a nice hole.
I thought that was a style decision. So it's like, I don't know, like maybe like you're climbing and you like, you know, like cotton just doesn't have good friction. You know, you need to get that skin on skin contact when you're doing those elbow bars or arm bars. You know, you're just like,
yeah. Unfortunately, no, I'm not that cool. All my money is now spent on pole dancing.
Just to be clear, guys, he's the one doing the pole dancing. He's not paying for people to pole dance for him. That I think is more common, but Tom is paying just to get on the pole himself.
That's right. And so, yeah, it's not, I'm not throwing dollar bills. If you go to my Instagram,
it's impressive.
Did you see
it? Yeah, it pops up on my feed, and you know, I'll watch it for a little while. It's impressive. It's muscularly intense stuff.
Yeah, I'm not doing it for the women.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, maybe a little bit.
it's not a difficult sport to take part in. Yeah. I'll give you that. But yeah, so if you go to at Useful to Coach. And actually look at, it's one of the highlights, I think, or whatever they're called, you know, the story highlights. I did a performance for a Christmas party at the studio that I've been learning pole. So I've been learning since March, and I did a performance with a teacher, and it was a lot of fun. And I think I'm going to carry on doing it. So I'm sure I'm going to launch I actually already do pole nutrition on my website. I haven't had a single client yet, but I do offer aerial and pole nutrition coaching. If there's anybody out there list wanting to do that. Okay.
Easier than polo nutrition, because then you got to consider, you know, both human and equine nutrition. It just gets really complicated.
Water polo nutrition.
That would be easier.
Yes. So, yeah. So on that point, so in 2019, I'm hoping to, do a lot more with this podcast, no doubt there'll be some cool stuff coming. If it doesn't work out, then obviously, you know, I'll be a stripper on a pole.
Yeah, that's how he makes his money right now, and he can keep on doing it if he needs to, but wants to escape.
It doesn't make me a hoe.
The harsh world.
And on that note, we've hit 2 hours and 5 minutes. So you guys have got your money's worth.
Well, they're not paying us, Tom. So.
I will certainly wish you a happy Christmas.
Yeah, and holiday season in general.
A happy new year. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we'll be back in 2019. We'll either have a Q&A episode or a weight loss episode or maybe something completely unheard of as of yet, but probably not. Probably exactly. One of the first two options.
you can find Brian at climbingnutrition.com. You have his Patreon page link there. You can also find Climbing Nutrition, the Facebook page. You can find me at useful.coach, at usefulcoach on Instagram. And there is a Useful Coach Facebook page as well. I think that's it.
All right, everyone. Have a great December.
Right. Cheers, everyone. Thanks. Bye.